bit fanciful now at best.
Moscow is clearly being told to take note that the EU family is growing.
This is a powerful signal. This is a powerful signal that should be heard, not only in Ukraine.
But the message seems to have fallen flat on its face. Vladimir Putin says he's no objections to Ukraine joining the EU. The Kremlin's issue has always been related to Kiev becoming a member of the NATO military alliance. It's been reported that officials in the European Commission filled out the country's EU application form. A number of legislators point out the EU's own studies have found that Ukraine is highly corrupt. Therefore, they suggest the country is not eligible. Analysts say it could take up to 10 years for Ukraine to become a full member of the bloc.
In this context, it has been suggested by some lawmakers here that the true motive is to yet again use Ukraine as a pawn to try and undermine Russia. Jerome Hughes at the European Parliament, Brussels.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's topic, what is faith? Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's topic, we want to cover a very important point, and that is the point of faith, or al-Iman. What is faith in its essence? Well, no doubt, every one of us know that we have different ideas. We have knowledge about many things, but we don't have that belief and that faith in it. What does that mean? It means that the knowledge has levels in our soul. It has levels in ourselves. There are instances of knowledge where we know something, and with the passage of time, it just goes out of our mind, and we don't have any kind of connection and attention to that thing. This type of knowledge is something we cannot call it faith or belief. But another things we know that when we know them, the ideas, which not just that we have a knowledge of them, but they become rooted in our self. They become ingrained in our very essence. They become part of us. We cannot deny them. We cannot minus them from our thought. They are part of us. They are part of our intellectual life. Such an idea and such a thought, which becomes ingrained and rooted in your personality, is called belief, is called the faith. That's what becomes rooted and ingrained in your thought and in yourself. Welcome back. This is A to Z. We were talking about faith. Well, in the last segment, we talked about the reality of the faith. It is the kind of idea or a view which becomes ingrained and rooted in our personality. So you cannot detach it from yourself easily. It becomes rooted in you. So some of the scholars says that there are two type of connections in the faith. First is the connection which is between the subject and its predicate, the subject and the judgment. That connection is the first point in the faith. And second is the connection between the central subject of that statement and your soul, yourself. These together make the faith. If there is an idea, if there is a view which is rooted and connected to your soul, it is called the faith. Now, is there any hint and indication in Islam about this? Yes. In Quran, Allah says, قَالَتِ الْأَعْرَابُ آمَنَّا قُلْ لَمْ تُؤْمِنُوا وَلَكِنْ قُولُوا أَسْلَمْنَا وَلَمَّا يَدْخُلُ الْإِيمَانُ فِي قُلُوبِكُمْ. When there were people in the life of holy prophets, they used to say that we have faith in Islam. We have faith. We believed in Islam. Quran says that tell them, O holy prophet, tell them, لَمَّا يَدْخُلُ الْإِيمَانُ فِي قُلُوبِكُمْ. Tell them, you should say that we have submission to Islam. We have the submission towards Allah. But don't say that we have iman and faith, because وَلَمَّا يَدْخُلِ الْإِيمَانُ فِي قُلُوبِكُمْ, because the faith and the reality of the belief has not reached your hearts. So what is faith? It is something which is rooted in our heart, which you cannot forget about easily. So faith is something rooted deep in your heart, and that is why we need to make faith rooted in our heart. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala help us to have real belief in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says the European Union and NATO are gathering a coalition for war with Moscow. This after the EU unanimously granted candidacy status to Ukraine and Moldova. Lavrov drew parallels between current-day events and those of the first half of the 20th century when Germany was preparing an attack on the Soviet Union.
When the Second World War was about to start, Hitler gathered most of the European countries under his banners. Now the EU and NATO are also gathering the same modern coalition for the fight, and by and large for war with the Russian Federation. We will look at this very carefully.
Lavrov's remarks came after the EU leaders stepped up rhetoric against Russia.
EU's decision strengthens Ukraine and Moldova in the face of Russian aggression.
A confrontation between Moscow and NATO's nuclear armed members would have catastrophic consequences for Europe. After all, Europe would be the immediate theater of such a war.
In terms of the possibilities of war, NATO fighting a war with Russia, I don't think they are very good. First of all, because the United States will not suffer as a result of this war, the Europeans will suffer. The Europeans, if they start down this path, they will unleash a nuclear war, in which case their entire, all of the NATO countries will be destroyed, all of the NATO bases. It will be a catastrophe for these people. And I think the leaders of the three major countries, Germany, France, and Italy, I think they understand this. And I think that's why they have been going to Kiev to have discussions with President Zelensky. They know that the people, this is not in their interest.
Candidate status is only the first step on the path to EU membership, which can take decades. But putting the EU action in the context of the current state of affairs, we can see that the rising escalation might quickly lead to catastrophic consequences. Tensions are also increasing between the EU and Russia over the growing Kaliningrad crisis. This after Lithuania began enforcing the EU sanctions and restricted the transit of goods to Kaliningrad. Moscow says the move amounts to a blockade of its exclave and has warned of serious consequences.
As for retaliatory measures and what they will be like, will they be exclusively in the diplomatic dimension? The answer is no. They will not be in the diplomatic dimension. They will be practical.
A move by Russia on Lithuania would clearly trigger NATO's Article 5 mutual defense provision, immediately pulling in all the alliance's members to a potential nuclear war with Russia. But how far can the Europeans really push for such an escalatory path with Russia, especially at a time when they are experiencing an energy crisis?
If you're asking me personally, I personally think that the main reason for the war in the Ukraine was to block the alliance between Germany and Russia. And the symbol of that alliance was the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which never got opened. As a result, now Germany is in a critical crisis because Russia has control of its energy. Russia just turned dialed down 40% of its energy. Germany cannot survive under these conditions. It is not in Germany's interest to commit suicide for the United States of America.
On Thursday, Ukraine said it had received U.S. supplies of high-mobility artillery rocket systems, a powerful long-range weapon system that Kiev hopes can help turn the tide on Russia's military offensive. Russian officials have repeatedly warned that the U.S. decision to supply Ukraine with advanced rocket systems could exacerbate the conflict.
Iran has released fresh details about the covert and planned operations of agents of Israeli spy agency in Iran. Officials say the three agents detained back in April were planning to assassinate Iranian nuclear scientists. Officials say the agents were arrested following a complicated intelligence operation that lasted 8 months. Judiciary officials say some members of the cell have been arrested in Iran's southeastern Sistan and Balochistan province, while other members and operatives have been detained outside the province by Iran's intelligence forces. Officials say the case is under preliminary investigation and that an indictment would be filed and sent to court soon. This is not the first time Iran busts Mossad-linked terrorists. In July last year, Iran's intelligence ministry arrested a network of agents with the Israeli Mossad spy agency at the western borders, confiscating a large cache of weapons and ammunition that they were planning to use to provoke riots and terror inside the country.
Well, of course there should be, and I don't think anyone is really going to seriously say it's unthinkable that Israel would try to assassinate Iranian figures, whether in science or politics. They've got a demonstrable propensity to do so, and they boast about it.
The arrests come amid open threats by Israeli officials against Iranian nuclear scientists and facilities. The regime is notorious for its sabotage activities and assassinations in Iran.
And the reason behind its stepped-up hostility toward Iran, and a very open hostility, is that Israel seeks to be the lone superpower, or you could say mini superpower, of the region as a junior partner of the big superpower, the United States.
Israel has tried various ways to stop Iran's nuclear progress. They include acts of sabotage, assassinating Iranian nuclear scientists, as well as threats to bomb Iran's nuclear installations. Probably the most high-profile assassination was the killing of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, a top Iranian nuclear scientist who was brutally murdered by Mossad agents in 2020. Mossad was involved in an explosion that hit Iran's Natanz nuclear facility in 2021. Israel was also the main regional force that pushed the United States to exert economic and diplomatic pressure on Iran. The policy culminated in the so-called maximum pressure campaign of former President Donald Trump. But none of those policies reached their stated goals. Iran's economy did not collapse, and its nuclear program has accelerated massively after the U.S. quit the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, in 2018.
It's the whole establishment, the whole Israeli establishment, that has this extreme hostility toward Iran and wants to continue to take action in the hopes of provoking something greater. It carries out assassinations, there's no question about that. It carries out bombings inside the country, carried out by covert agents. I think right now the United States government is not wishing to see an escalation into a full-blown war. And Israel does, in the final analysis, have to pay attention to what Washington thinks and says.
Just recently, a top U.S. think tank admitted to Israel's failure towards Iran. A report by Atlantic Council said that Israel's policy has failed to stop Iran. The article said the Tel Aviv regime needs to recalculate and adopt a strategy that corresponds to the current state of the Iranian nuclear program. Given the current state of affairs, the United States, which is Israel's staunch ally, needs to reconsider its unilateral support for Israel.
The meeting of leaders of the BRICS group of nations occurs amid major shifts in the geopolitical order. Talks have been held in a virtual format for the third consecutive year. The group owes its name to the initials of its five member states, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, and emerged in 2009. This year, leaders focused on global economy and the changing dynamics of geopolitical and strategic alliances. Russia has already called on the group's members to integrate their payment systems and use their respective national currencies for intra-organizational trade. The call came amid the West's unprecedented anti-Russia sanctions over Moscow's military operation in Ukraine. The coercive economic measures have cut some Russian banks off from the SWIFT interbank messaging and financial system, and tensions with the West. China also sees the summit as a platform to promote its vision for how international relations should be conducted. Chinese President Xi Jinping made a four-point proposal on pursuing high-quality development of BRICS cooperation. Xi stressed that BRICS countries, as important emerging markets and major developing countries, need to act with a sense of responsibility to bring positive, stabilizing, and constructive strength to the world.
But if you look at the Western nations, in particular in the U.S., there's a strong anti-globalization trend. And what the U.S. is doing today is basically create a lot of, mischievous behavior policies to disrupt global supply chain. That creates a lot of problems. So in that sense, I think the nations, they have a lot in common. And it's obviously everybody understands if they can unite with each other and have their voice heard, and they can better defend their interests and better build a more fairer and, say, a more just international order.
This year's agenda covered a range of topics, but particular emphasis was given to renewing multilateralism for global economic recovery, deepening coordination on climate action, and strengthening coordination on public health.
I think there are probably several issues, several reasons why it's resilient, why it's emerging stronger and stronger as a grouping. And firstly, I think it's, you know, they have something in common. That is, they feel this international system, which was established mostly by Western countries, is not fair, is not just enough for developing countries, for example. We know that is Western countries' dominant international system. When the Western countries talk about, you know, rules-based international order, often those rules are produced in Washington or in Brussels.
The economy has always been at the heart of the BRICS, but the Ukraine war loomed large over the summit. The economic impact of the war and the sanctions on Russia is showing across the world. Inflation is up in many countries, global supply chains have been disrupted, and there are fears of food shortages. Russia and China see the group as potential counterweight against Western-led hegemonic desires and imperialist intentions.
Obviously, now we are seeing the emerging of the multilateral world. You know, you have Russia, which basically made it very public that the unilateral world has concluded. And the U.S. should accept that kind of reality, harsh reality for them. And with the rise of China, and we are basically seeing a center, a new center. You know, before China's emerging power, you can see like, Washington would say the world center is in Washington, is in the U.S. And now you have a new center in Beijing.
BRICS nations have a combined population of 3.23 billion, and their combined GDP is more than $23 trillion. China proposed expanding the BRICS grouping during a meeting of the bloc's foreign ministers in May. Though the suggestion was welcomed by other member countries, there have been no official announcements of who the new members might be. Colombia witnesses a historic moment as it votes in its first ever leftist leader. Gustavo Petro, former rebel and mayor of the capital Bogota, beat his businessman rival Rodolfo Hernandez in a tense election. The voting took place as the country is plagued by the economic fallout from the COVID-19 pandemic and social unrest. Public dissatisfaction triggered massive protests in Colombia last year. But Petro has vowed to bring about profound social and economic change.
What's coming here is real change. Real change. That is what we are committing our lives to. We will not betray the electorate that has demanded that Colombia change from today.
Petro's victory demonstrates a continuing trend in the recent years that many countries in the region swing to the left, indicating in some sense that the world is about to witness a Latin American integration in light of ideological alignment between the governments.
So with the victory of the historic pact in Colombia, we are definitely seeing a new horizon for Latin American integration. Just several years ago, it was the same countries of Colombia, Peru, Chile that were, you know, in the forefront of forming groups such as the Lima Group, which was formed precisely in order to attack Venezuela and undermine regional integration, dividing the region, antagonizing other countries within the region. And now we're seeing a very different scenario with the shift to the left of Honduras, of Chile, of Peru, and a potential shift to the left in Brazil. This means that these kind of formations, which have been put forward by the United States, such as the Lima Group, are no longer possible.
Now, Petro's victory in Colombia and the possibility of a Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva win in Brazil have brought expectations for a new cycle of cooperation in the region. If Lula succeeds, Latin America's five biggest countries, Brazil, Mexico, Argentina, Colombia, and Chile, will be broadly speaking ideologically aligned and in principle open to establishing constructive bilateral ties. The victory of Gustavo Petro in Colombia's presidential election has continued a leftward swing in Latin America and was quickly praised by left-wing leaders across the region. Argentinian President Alberto Fernandez said the win paves the way to maximum solidarity in Latin America. Similar messages of unity were relayed by the leaders of Bolivia, Chile, and Mexico. Meanwhile, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, who had fraught relations with outgoing Colombian President Iván Duque over the latter's support of Venezuelan opposition figure Juan Guaido, also welcomed Petro's victory. And considering the uniformity forming in Latin America, the region seems to be on the path of shifting away from U.S. dependence.
And as I mentioned before, this shift to the left in the countries that you have mentioned, Argentina, Peru, Chile, Mexico, Bolivia, Honduras, also definitely demarcates a shift away from the United States. I think the United States knows that the different rulers that it's propped up in all of these countries, the different maneuvers that it has tried to carry out in countries such as Bolivia, in Honduras, are no longer going to be accepted. The fact that the U.S. strongholds, Honduras and Colombia, in Latin America and the Caribbean, were shifted to the left and had historic victories of people's movements that have rejected the same leaders that the U.S. has put in these countries.
So far, most right-wing presidents in Latin America faithfully followed the dictates of Washington. Colombia's outgoing president was a prime example, and this was demonstrated by his support of government change efforts in Venezuela. But Petro has previously committed to restoring diplomatic relations with the Maduro government. The Colombian president-elect stance on regional issues sheds light on a new horizon, not only for his country but for Latin American nations, and further cooperation amongst them considering their shared ideologies. Nonetheless, all the recent developments in the region in some sense indicate a brighter future for the region amid strengthened ties, and what seems to be a new start for Latin American integration.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
اقرأ باسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا
قد دعوتك ربي بقرآني جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفراني.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجه. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to Let's Recite the Quran Kareem with Habibullah Fazizada and also our dear students from Sevier International School and IRIB Radio, English Radio. So we really welcome you all and thank you so much for joining us again. We hope that everyone is fine and healthy and inshallah protected from all evils. القرآن هدي الإيمان القرآن مسك الختام يا قرآن عليك سلام. Alhamdulillah, everyone is fine here and we hope that you're fine as well. So guys, ready inshallah to go and start our lesson?
Yes.
That's great. So we really give thanks to IRIB English Radio and also Sevier International Schools Network that have provided the chance for us. And also, first and foremost, we give thanks to Allah Almighty. Okay. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen. So let's go, inshallah, and start. In the previous session, we were like talking about the heaviness and lightness of the Arabic alphabet letters, yes? And we said that we have two groups, heavy letters, light letters. Just one thing was left here about the letter Ra, and that was about Hamzatul Wasl and also Maddilin, okay? Or Yailin. You know, Yailin means this, a sakin Ya, which has like a fatha before. For example, Ba with fatha and then Ya with sukun. How do you read it?
Bay.
Bay. Jim with fatha and ya sukun, jay. So this is yailin. It's called yailin because you produce a soft lean means layin. You remember, yeah? I think that means that soft sound, soft a sound. Look, li ilafi quraish, a soft a sound. So if we have a ra after this yailin. After this yailin, and if it is also sakin because we stop at that word, okay, stop at that word again. That ra is producing a heavy sound. Why? Because I told you there is a rule. We have a fatha sound. Fatha sound. Khair. Which one? Khair or khair?
First one.
The second one.
Why? Because we still have a fatha sound. Khair. There are sometimes some exceptional rules. That ma'yailin is that exceptional.
Yes.
Okay? So the other cases you have to pay attention to that fatha or that fatha sound. But when it comes to yailin, okay? Yailin. Or there is a ya sakin. Doesn't matter. It's yailin or no. Qadir, for example. So now. Khai, say the letter ra. Khai, which, how? Heavy, light. Khai.
Ra.
Khair.
Ra.
Ra.
Khair. No.
Khair.
If it is khairi, of course it's light. If it is khaira, it's heavy. Khairu, it's heavy. But it's sakin. Khair.
Yes. Heavy. Light sound.
Light sound. I said, okay. I explained it with heavy sound. But that's an exceptional rule, okay? That do not pay attention here with yailin. Do not pay attention to that heavy, I mean that fatha sound, okay? So with yailin, we have that light sound. That's all about the letter ra, temporary
heavy
and sometimes
light.
So we have two rules for this. Tafkhim.
And tarqiq.
Right? So tarqiq means like producing
a light sound.
Tafkhim,
producing a heavy sound.
And those were the cases that we just studied so far.
هذا القرآن يوحدنا لطريق الخير يوجهنا الله تعالى أنزله ورسول الله معلمنا ورسول الله معلمنا هذا القرآن.
Want to learn Quran at home? Join us in our Quranic class. Let's recite the Quran.
So alhamdulillah, we finished the heavy letters and the light letters. But remember, okay, that inshallah when we go to the next topics, like for example, idgham, ghunna, ikhfa, again we have these heavy letters. Because, for example, we have like min qabl, min nun. Is nun a heavy letter?
No.
No.
No, it's not a heavy letter. It's a light letter. But when it comes close to the letter qaf, because qaf is
heavy
letter. And we are producing, and we are like, we have to apply the ikhfa rule here. So ikhfa is now with a heavy letter. Okay? Ikhfa plus heavy letter. So inshallah, we'll study that here. You have to produce a heavy noon sound. Look, heavy sound. Not mean. Heavy. Okay? So inshallah, we'll go through them. Again, I mean, we have this heavy and light sounds. Okay? One more thing. You have to remember that if we have... It's about Alif Maddi. I think I told you before as well. But I will repeat it. If we have Alif Maddi, what's Alif Maddi? Sound, right?
Yes.
Right. Like the longer sound.
The longer sound, yes.
Longer Fatha sound. That's great. So if we have that Alif Maddi, the letter that comes with this Alif Maddi, for example, Ba with Alif Maddi, Ta with Alif Maddi, any light letter with Alif Maddi will produce
a long,
long, sound.
Long light sound.
Long light,
long
sound.
Light, yes.
Okay. Like if we say with ba, it will be ba.
That's like, nice. Light, yes. Sound. Ba has a light sound, but when it comes to Alif Maddi, again it produces a light sound, sound, but light sound.
Long,
longer one. Ba, ta, ja, da, sa. But when it comes with a heavy letter.
Heavy, long,
heavy,
sound.
Heavy, long, longer heavy sound. Sound.
Bo? Yes,
bo?
With a heavy letter.
Bo is a light letter.
Bo.
No, a heavy letter with Alif Maddi. Like what?
Like.
So. Ho. So. Yes.
Ba.
Ba. Ba.
Ba.
Nice one.
Ba.
Yeah. Wala dhalin. Yeah. So one question. Who can recite Surah Al-Fatiha correctly? You must be able to recite it correctly. Yeah? So anyone? Now I will ask you. Let's see, okay? Who recites the best? Let's recite a salawat, but first. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. So let's recite this surah, okay? Let's see. And then, inshallah, we'll go to the new rule, which is about... the rules of Noon Sakin and Tanween.
Mm-hmm.
It's very important. Four important rules are there. Four important rules. Which I can tell you that they are like among the most important ones. The key rules in Tajweed. Ikhfa, Iqlab, Idhar, Idgham. These four rules are very, very important. Inshallah, we'll go through them. So
here is Bismillah a verse?
Yeah, it's part of the first verse. It means Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. With the first verse, we count them as first verse. That's why we have, at the beginning of every surah, we have like this, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, okay? We have this. Only once, like, how many surahs do we have, Hussein Musa, in the Quran?
God 114. Knows.
114 surahs. And how many Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim do we have?
114.
Huh? No, 13. 114. 14. 14. 14. 14. 14. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim we have. Yes. But... all the surahs do not start with Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
One surah.
113 surahs start with Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. One surah doesn't start with Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Yes.
And where is that Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim? In another surah. In Surah An-Naml.
An-Naml?
I think yes. When it's about the story of Prophet Solomon. Okay? Uh-huh. Yeah. And when he writes a letter to that lady. Okay? Bilqis, I think.
Uh-huh.
So writing a letter to her. Okay? And it starts with Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. There, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. It's talking about that letter. So that Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim is there. So the reason why that surah, another surah, Surah to
Naml.
No, this Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim is written in this surah, okay?
Yes.
It means in this surah we have two Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. One at the beginning, one at the middle, okay?
Yes.
So what's the other surah having no Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim?
Tawbah.
It doesn't start. Or Bara'at. Surah to Bara'at. Okay? And the reason? Do you know the reason?
Yes.
Yeah, no. Because okay.
God is using
angry words.
Yes.
So he is like announcing that there will be no more chance for the pagans of Mecca. Yeah.
Yes, but when we say Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, so
Ar-Rahman and Ar-Rahim, they are like forgiving.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Now Allah is very much angry. Okay, that I will not be forgiving anymore to you. Yes.
Yes.
Okay, that's good. So, inshallah, you'll study more in tafsir classes about them. So, let's go to Surah Al-Fatiha. Hussein Ruhullah, would you start? Please recite this surah.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Ar-Rahmanir Rahim. Maliki Yawmiddin. إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين اهدنا الصراط المستقيم صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين.
Oh, mashallah, thank you so much. That was so good. But there were some points. First one, who knows?
He said عَلَى instead of غَى.
Okay, مَعْضُوب, yes.
معذوب, yes.
Yeah, that was clear, so clear. And about the heavy letters,
ضالي.
ولا الضو. Heavy with ألف مديريس. ولا الضو. There is a mad also.
Yes.
ولا الضالين. Okay. There was another mistake. With this heavy letter, raw. Alhamdulillahi. Read it again.
Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen.
Rabbil Alameen. Rabbil Alameen.
Alhamdulillahi
Rabbil Alameen. Okay, that's nice. Okay. So, any other mistakes? About, like, short vowels and long vowels, okay? Like when you say iyaka, iyaka, it means you're producing a short vowel sound with ya. Iyaka, no. We have an alif there. Iyaka, iyaka na'budu wa iyaka nasta'in. Okay. Thank you so much, inshallah. Hussein Musa and Fawad Haider and I will recite this surah after short break. See you inshallah in the next session. Stay with us, okay? Inshallah we'll be back. Thank you so much. Let's recite a salawat.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajil fajr.
Let's recite the Quran. A joint production of IRIB English Radio and Xavier International Schools. ذكر وموعظة ونور فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا
Social news. Social news. Scientific news. Artistic news. With the light.
Staff at the National Zoo of Cuba in the capital city of Havana are celebrating a new arrival of a rare baby white rhinoceros. The little calf, named Al, quickly became popular among other animals in the park after he was born. He is part of a conservation program that will add to a gene bank for future breeding. Al is the second white rhinoceros to be born in captivity in 18 years. The park is home to 8 white rhinos and 4 black ones. Zoo staff say the park has one of the largest exhibits of this mammal among zoos in Latin America. White rhinos are endangered species and their population has dwindled due to illegal poaching and environmental destruction.
Persian fallow deer is a unique but endangered species known for its sleek and spotted body. In this report, our correspondent Youssef Jalali takes us on a quick tour around one of the world's few protected shelters of Persian fallow deer in Iran's city of Sari.
We had to keep quiet and avoid making any sounds to film them, as they are shy and swift, and the slightest sound could send them sprinting and jumping away. Over 60 Persian fallow deer roam in Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge in Iran's northern city of Sari. The endangered species is carefully protected here to be safe from predators and poachers.
The Persian fallow deer is native to Iran's Khuzestan province, but due to loss of habitat and threats posed to them by predators such as jackals and wild cats, they are endangered and need to be protected in semi-natural refuges like this one.
Persian fallow deer are mainly indigenous to open woodland areas spanning from East Mediterranean coasts to West and Southwest Iran. By 1875, they had gone extinct in all of their main habitats, except in Southwest Iran. After a captive breeding program, the population has rebounded from only a handful of deer in the 1960s to over 200 individuals in Iran.
Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge is a 55 hectares wide. It was introduced in 1962 as a shelter for the Persian fallow deer when the species was on the brink of extinction. At that time, 5 deer were captured and translocated to this refuge. Over the past 6 decades, their number have been multiplied through captive breeding.
The Persian fallow deer is a rare ruminant mammal belonging to the family Cervidae. They're physically larger than other fallow deer, and their antlers are bigger and less palmate. Their special beauty has turned this sanctuary into a hot tourist attraction in Iran's north.
This sanctuary is a tourist destination for visitors who would like to see the Hyrkanian forests in Iran's north and at the same time enjoy the wildlife and learn about efforts made to save the Persian fallow deer from extinction.
In 2015, the Persian fallow deer was registered in the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species. Dashtinaz authorities hope through continued captive breeding, the population of these special creatures will soon reach the desired number, and hopefully they will be reintroduced to their natural habitat in southwest Iran.
While they live far from their original habitat, these alluring creatures feel at home here, where they will be safe from the dangers lurking outside, which may lead to their extinction. So here, Persian fallow deer continue to embellish the nature and charm visitors with their beauty. Youssef Jalali from Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge in Sari.
Catching fish makes you forget even the most complex problems, but think the moment you catch the strangest one. Well, a Cambodian fisherman has caught what researchers say is the world's biggest freshwater fish ever recorded. The giant fish, which weighs around 300 kilograms and 4 meters long, was caught last week from the Mekong River. The female stingray was released back into water after being electronically tagged to allow scientists to monitor her movement and behavior. The fish was named Barami, meaning full moon in the Khmer language. An American fish biologist, Dana Lee, says the data collected from Barami can help protect the species and its habitat.
We got a call this morning at breakfast that they had caught a giant stingray here at Coprea. So we dropped everything. People came up from Phnom Penh, and we're here now just at sunset. Just tagged the giant, a 330-kilogram giant stingray here in the Mekong River, and released it here right at sunset.
The stingray dethrones the former record holder, a 290-kilogram catfish found in northern Thailand in 2005. More than 1,000 species live in the Mekong River. The famous waterway originates in China and twists south through parts of Thailand, Laos, Myanmar, Cambodia, and Vietnam. Scientists have warned that plastic waste and dam threaten wildlife even in the deepest stretches of the Mekong. Geologists are rejoicing over a new discovery. A 290-million-old fossil forest has accidentally been found in southern Brazil. A team of geologists had been sent to the state of Paraná to investigate the rocks there. To their surprise, they were able to find over 160 logs of lycophytes, an extinct variety of the vascular plant subgroup. It's quite rare occurrence that a large number of fossils of the plant were found preserved in upright position for such a long time. The forest itself was discovered in 2018 when a street was being constructed over there. So far, only two other similar collections have been found in smaller forest areas of Brazil and Argentina.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
June 21st marks the International Day of Yoga. On this day, people, especially Hindus around the world, gather in open spaces to perform this ancient physical exercise, raising awareness of its benefits on the human body and mind. Yoga is believed to have originated in India thousands of years ago and is mentioned in ancient Hindu mythological books. The word yoga derives from Sanskrit and means to join or unite, symbolizing the union of body and consciousness. In India, the day is celebrated with a different theme each year, with this year's theme being Yoga for Humanity. Mass yoga events took place around India, especially in and around iconic sites such as the Taj Mahal. Other countries, such as Vietnam and Thailand, also celebrated Yoga Day with hundreds performing it in open spaces. Agriculture is no exception when it comes to adapting new technologies in the context of changing climate. Now, French farmers in the northwestern suburbs of Paris grow greens in any season using hydroponic farms. Residents of a housing estate have ditched the traditional way of farming to create jobs for their community. Hydroponic farming is a method of growing plants in water, not in soil. It may sound like it would be a complicated process, but it's actually quite straightforward. The system is made of plastic and uses a rich organic ecosystem. The workers use less water than usual and do not even need a teaspoon of soil. one of the employees describes how they turned barren land into a farm.
It used to be a garage where they stored cars, but since there were no more cars, we used it as a dormitory. We listened to music and watched football matches. We used to meet here to have a bit of privacy and breathe, to hide away for a while. But now that it's become a place of work, I'm happy because I'm working.
Hydroponic farms can be used to grow products of all kinds in any region. In this one, farmers are planting all sorts of things, ranging from Peruvian mint to Vietnamese coriander. They hope that the system can be used to help local residents, especially those who need it the most.
People in Poland have rolled out flower carpets for the feast of Corpus Christi held in the central village of Spiszemierz. Families usually arrange colorful and symbolic carpets for the procession on the road section in front of their homes. They use flowers picked from the surrounding fields or their own gardens. They also use soil, sand and fresh cut grass. The procession begins from the church and roams the streets of the village. The flower carpets have been rolled out annually since the tradition started 200 years ago, except for once when a storm broke out.
This tradition is 200 years old, and according to what the village elders say, it has only happened once that there was no carpet of flowers for the procession, because a storm broke out and swept everything away in the afternoon.
Families begin collecting the flowers a few days before the feast and arrange it on the celebration day. Besides its religious aspect, the event is also meant to express appreciation for nature. The practice has been passed from generation to generation ever since it began. The tradition was registered at UNESCO's cultural heritage list last year.
Artists have turned a historic village in the Tunisian island of Djerba into a vibrant open-air art museum. The organizer of the project says he has always had a clear vision for the gallery.
The goal of this project is to create a new way of displaying urban art, to create a museum, a real museum, which labels for the works with a certain lighting, certain works and staging. Also to create a dynamic to give this museum to the residents so that they could appropriate it and it almost becomes their business.
The project is called Djerbehud and it's located in a town of Eriad. Since 2014, about 150 artists from 35 different nations have gathered there to produce eye-catching street art. Tourists say they enjoy visiting the gallery because they can see something new every time they come round. Residents of the town are also content with the vibrant looks of their streets, saying the artwork give a little movement to their everyday lives.
IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.